And we are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3,665 of the Survival Podcast. Today is Monday, May the 5th, 2025, which means I didn't get to say May the 4th be with you on the 4th of May on the show because it was a Sunday, but May the 4th be with you anyway. Anyway, so what are we going to talk about today? I got a great show lined up for you guys today. I was just a few moments ago wondering, is this going to happen or is it going to happen and be like one of those, like, Max Headroom ones where there's jerkiness in the video feed and all. We had some storms move through, and they're just about gone on the radar, at least the intense ones. And one big loud lightning crack went off, and then the lights did the thing you never want them to do. Okay? And Pat Rohrman, who was a lineman, explained to me recently up in Tennessee why you don't want this. I won't get into it, but they went off, they came back on again, and they went off again. When they start doing that shit, that's usually when you end up with a long-term outage. Something bad happens in the system. But when they came back on the second time, they stayed on. And then it took about 15 minutes for the internet to sync, which that usually doesn't happen. Now, I don't know a lot about electrical line work, but I know a lot about cable TV work. And, you know, when something like that happens, it's very easy for something like an amp or something to get fried. And then you've got to wait for a tech to come out and replace it. But it did come back, so we're not tethered to a phone. We've got full internet, and hopefully this will be an uneventful podcast from a technical standpoint. That's what people always ask me, like, how was your flight? The best answer you'll ever get out of me was uneventful. You know, you get on an airplane, you get on at a time you're supposed to, you leave at the time you're supposed to, you get off at the time you're supposed to. They don't bump you. You get the seat you're supposed to have. That's all I want out of a flight. That's all I want out of the technical side of a podcast. If I screw it up from a presentation standpoint, oh, well. But technically, if we could just have no eventfulness, then we will be in good shape. Based on the radar, we shouldn't have further interruption, but we shall see. What are we going to talk about today? I'm going to lead off with a few Bitcoin questions. I got a lot of questions on something called Bitcoin Knots. This is for you folks that run nodes. That's the only people it's for. What is it? Why would you do it? Does it matter? We've got a completely idiotic comment on a Bitcoin episode I did recently. I'll read to you, and it's like, I think you're confusing Bitcoins and shitcoins, and you'll see why when we read it. We're talking a little bit about over-the-counter Bitcoin trading, which actually shows how stupid that comment was from such an uninformed angle. And I have a question that's not really a Bitcoin question. It's more like a hard money question, just Bitcoin would fill the role. If we ever did move to a hard money standard again, what would lending look like? Would it restore beautiful architecture like we had during hard money periods? If it did, how long would it work for? Like, how long would it take for it to actually kick in? Questions like that. How would lending work in that environment? Like, it really makes sense how lending works in this environment. How would lending work in a hard money environment? Then we're going to move on about mushrooms. We have a follow-up question. Guy remembers very bad experience from his father eating a mushroom or three he shouldn't have, and, you know, vomiting and looking like he was on the edge of death before he recovered. So he's a little queasy about growing his own mushrooms, though he loves mushrooms. I'll tell you why. When you're growing your own, even in compost piles like he's asking about, you're in pretty good shape. You're in pretty good shape. If you know what you planted and you are only harvesting what you planted and you know to look for lookalikes of what you planted, and most of our cultivated mushrooms have very few true lookalikes. And if there is anything somewhat similar, there's a definitive characteristic we can look at to see the difference. We also have somebody wrote in, but they have mulch piles setting themselves on fire. It's actually their neighbor. All of a sudden, a mulch pile starts not steaming, starts smoking. Yeah, we'll cover that one. And there's a real easy way to prevent that from happening, but it is a thing. And if you're getting lots of chips from like chip.io or whatever, you need to know about this, right? Or chip drop or whatever it is. What about making bone char? Anything special to do with that? And then what about, can you make char out of clamshells? Bone char, yes. Sort of, kind of, a little bit special, but not that much. Clamshells, not really. I'll explain why when we get to that one. But there's a new truck out there. It's a $20,000 truck. It's really a $27,500 truck. The $20,000 number is based on some voodoo mathematics and early numbers called the Slate. If you want to know what I think of it, I got a bunch of questions on this the last couple of weeks because it's kind of been making the rounds, and I have mixed opinions on it. then how responsible should you feel to take care of neighbors in a shit hit the fan scenario? And does it matter what kind of shit hit the fan scenario it is? Then why is the rare earth deal that we just made with Ukraine probably a signal that the end of the war is not far off, even though we've just had people like J.D. Vance saying the war is not going to stop anytime soon? Why is that probably not true? Expectation management and such. And then what is our biggest problem going forward with the Trump plan, which really, to be fair, started maybe with Trump one and was already kind of happening under Biden. Things like the CHIP Act, et cetera, were under Biden. There is this plan to reindustrialize America, and it's not just Trump's plan. And I think it's actually being hurt by a lot of people who think it is the Trump plan, who just hate Trump, so they have to hate it because it's Trump's plan. But it's kind of a reinforcement that even when you change the president, even though something's changed in the end, the macro cycles are happening and they're being driven by other forces. And the plan really is we're going to use these tariffs, we're going to reestablish fair trades, and we're going to reindustrialize America. But there's something missing. What is it? I'll tell you when we get there. Before that, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day, number one today, is KnifeKits.com, where anybody, even a person as skillless as me, can learn to make a knife by using a kit as your starting foundation. You can make all different types of kit knives, just about every form, function you can come up with. And from there, you can move on to doing things with your own raw materials if you want to, or just stay in that lane. It can be a hobby. It can be a side hustle. It can turn into a full-time business. They also have all the material you need for making things like kydex and leather sheets, as well as kydex holsters and just a bunch of really cool stuff. And they've been a sponsor of the show for like 15 years, guys. That's forever in the world of podcasting. I don't really know if anybody else out there has the kind of lasting relationship with sponsors in a podcast arena that we do. That says something about our sponsors. Next up today, though, Anton's Land of Biltong, biltongusa.com. Life is too short for average. Get your biltong from a guy that knows how to make it because he grew up where it comes from, South Africa. He's also kind of a warrior for liberty and freedom as well. I find a lot of people that immigrate to the United States legally from places like South Africa, Europe, etc., they have seen the ravages of what socialism and democratic socialism does. And so they are far more radically liberty oriented than a lot of people that were born here were kind of spoiled. Anton's one of those guys. He also makes amazing biltong. It's so good that he actually pays me for his sponsorship with biltong. With that, let's kind of dig into today's topics. Again, got a whole bunch of stuff. And we're going to start off with what is Bitcoin not, and should you even care? So I think not is not what some people are making it out to be. It is a useful thing. It is a version of basically an alternative vision of Bitcoin Core for your node. And if you don't know what a node is, then this discussion, you might want to even just tune out if you're watching live or you're not interested in learning, you know, or maybe skip ahead if you're listening to the replay. But a node is basically a little device that has the whole of the network, the blockchain on it from the Genesis block all the way up to now. And every 10 minutes, roughly, it participates in certifying the next block. That's what it is. And node runners, along with miners, together decide what code is actually being run. It takes the miners run, like if there's an actual change to the code from a standpoint of changing the protocol, then both sides have to agree. Both sides have to get over 51% and the market has to accept it. Otherwise, you end up with a contentious fork and one of them dies or goes off to be a secondary shitcoin like we have with Bitcoin Cash and eventually Bitcoin Satoshi Vision. So you have to have a conglomeration of all of these entities working together, the market, the miners, and the node operators to get enough consensus to change the code. Knots is not a code change. It is an alternative that you can run on your node, and it's backwards compatible, meaning it works with the main network. But it does allow you to censor some things out like, you know, ordinals, inscriptions, and stuff like that. But they're still on the chain. Your node's just not recovering, and you're not seeing them. But that's not really a good reason to run it, though some people that are behind it that like it and want it to become a new standard feel if you get enough node operators doing it, then maybe their miners become open to some sort of filtering of these inscriptions, ordinals, JPEGs, and shit all being inscribed on the Bitcoin network through a loophole that was left by the SegWit and Taproot upgrades, okay? And so then maybe you could get a code change, and some people are wrong. I don't think this goes that way for us. It doesn't seem like there's enough will for it right now. But the thing that Knots really does for you is give you more control over privacy, and that is useful, and it does things like it'll mask your IP address from where you're sending your Bitcoin. So that the public ledger in of itself is really all there is on the record of the transaction, and there's some other features. So we're not going to go deep into this because it's a highly technical thing. I'm not running Knots. Maybe I will move one of my nodes to Knots just for educational purposes, but I mean, that's all it'll really do for you right now. It's a decent, I would call it a privacy protocol, really, but it's more of a more control over certain aspects of pseudonymous privacy. Okay. That's all that it is for right now. If you have a question, do it like trial and error did right there. Word question in all caps followed by your question. That, of course, is for people in a live chat. If you do that in the comments, I might see it and follow up on it, but it doesn't really matter as much. I need that all capital question when I'm doing this because I only got one eye, right? And I'm alone today. I don't have any time to really be paying attention to the periphery. So that will help me a lot in answering your questions. All right. Let's move on from there. This comment that somebody left in my last Bitcoin episode is beyond ignorant. And I didn't say stupid. I said ignorant, meaning the person making the comment, I don't think they were a sniper or a hater or anything like that. I think they're just unaware. And I think the fact that I responded to this comment a little bit harsh, but not like, hey, you stupid idiot. Like, hey, this is how this works. And then within minutes, the guy deleted his comment, shows that he just didn't know. And he's like, hey, I just want this to all go away and pretend I never did it. So I'm not going to give his name. I don't think that would be fair to our friend. So we will just call him Jim. Jim said, I typically don't make it through the Bitcoin episodes, but I'll give it a go. My problem is most Bitcoin people I talk to. Okay, I want to stop you right there. Okay, when you listen to somebody talk about Bitcoin or anything else on the internet, on like a YouTube video, you're not talking to them. They're talking to you. It's a one direction conversation other than maybe some comments back and forth, which you can't take as a conversation. So I think what he means is when I hear Bitcoin people talk about Bitcoin. Okay. But here's where it goes south. Most Bitcoin people I talk to just want more people to buy it so they can sell at a profit. And that was the whole comment. Okay. I'm going to talk about over-the-counter Bitcoin bids next, and that will really drive home how ill-informed this comment is. But do you understand what you're saying? You're talking about an asset that trades around $24 billion worth of volume a day in open exchange accounts. That's Coinbase and Strike and little exchanges like Fold and big exchanges like Swan, shitcoin casinos, all of it. Like, All the open book trading of Bitcoin a day is about $24 billion of Bitcoin bought and sold on a daily basis. And so you really think that my video that maybe gets 1,300 people to listen to it is going to move the fucking price of Bitcoin? Do you think I don't care who it is. I don't care if it's Michael Saylor that's being interviewed by freaking, some other like Mark Moss. The two of them getting it. They're not going to move the price in of themselves with retail orders. There's not enough horsepower in any YouTuber, any podcaster that they can go on and say, hey, Bitcoin, buy Bitcoin, and also the price will go up so they can sell at a profit. You also don't understand Bitcoiners at all if you think selling at a profit is their main goal. There's a lot of people that are traders in this industry, not traitors, traders. And, yeah, they buy and sell and trade for profit, and they have no emotional connection to the asset at all. But those people are not spending a lot of time making videos and content kind of beefing up Bitcoin. The real point here is you just can't. You can't move the needle. Now, shitcoins, you can move the needle. And this is why shitcoins are not the valuable asset you think they are. I remember back this you know, was it 5-6 years ago when they did the first big pump on Dogecoin, which is a dumbass coin? And people are like, this guy's worth $1.7 billion now in Doge. No, he's not. Try to sell that shit and see what happens. See how fast, you know, when that guy puts it up for sale and that amount of volume hits a sell wall, how quickly that price just goes to shit, and we'll leave it there. My point is, I nor just about any other Bitcoiner, not shitcoiner, Bitcoiner out there, is ever going to pump up Bitcoin to you so that we can move the price. If I had that kind of power, I'd be doing other things with it. I'm telling you, like, it's just preposterous. So that brings us, and I always don't even tell the story, is just so we can understand how important this next stop is, which is called OTC, or over-the-counter Bitcoin trading. And this is something we really need to understand, because it also shows us that sooner or later, Bitcoin will pump to ridiculous levels. Okay? So over-the-counter means that when I, let's say I'm Michael Saylor and I'm about to buy, you know, $2 billion worth of Bitcoin. Michael Saylor, or the people at Strategy B that does what he says to do for him, they're not going to go to Coinbase and put it, I would like to buy $2 billion worth of Bitcoin, limit order at 96.5, buy. They're not going to do that. There's not enough Bitcoin on a freaking exchange to handle that depth without completely blowing up the price instantaneously. He's not going to divide that order up into, you know, four separate half-billion-dollar orders. There's not enough depth on most exchanges for that to happen from one buyer in one go. $2 billion in a $24 billion asset. It's what, 5% of the daily trading volume or more? 10% would be 2.4. Okay, it's about 10% of the daily trading volume. That's not going to happen. How do those big deals happen? Well, people like Strategy B or whoever wants to buy these large amounts of Bitcoin, even 5,000 Bitcoin in a single buy, will often reach out to their exchange of choice, Gemini, what have you. I would like to buy a lot of Bitcoin in one go. They're not going to go ahead. No, I'm talking like I want to buy like $500 million worth. Oh, sir, let me talk to you. Like right away, we're having a different conversation. And so they have large hodlers as well that sometimes want to divest a lot of Bitcoin, and they will put together maybe sometimes four or five sellers, and that Bitcoin will trade. You'll never see it on the exchanges. You'll just see it move on the public blockchain. They'll agree to certain terms. They'll have a much smaller spread, much lower fee. The exchange or exchanges necessary to put it together will get a much smaller piece of a much larger pie, and hence they make plenty of money. And people that you don't ever hear of, you never hear their names. They're not on Twitter trying to get you to do anything, or X trying to get you to do anything or whatever. They're the ones selling it, and they want this large capital raise, and they want the large capital raise all in one go. And the buyer doesn't want to spike the price while he's in the middle of the buy, and it keeps getting more expensive to buy less. That's over the counter. Now, this actually tells us something. I've done some analysis. I sanity checked it with AI, several different platforms. And there's room for maybe one more company making the kind of, you know, routine buys that Strategy B is making, MicroStrategy is making, before the whole over-the-counter system itself starts to break. You could get in, we just talked about 21 Capital recently, maybe half a dozen of those that are looking to start out with like 50,000 Bitcoin, slowly piecing it together before you break that system. There's a point where you can't do it anymore. There's a point where you can't do it anymore. And then you start to have things like a lot of this over-the-counter Bitcoin trading, you know who's selling? Miners, consortiums of miners who are stockpiling and then selling in order to cover costs, because they're selling large amounts in the thousands of Bitcoin, you know, per sale. So there's a point where the miners start to go, well, I see what's going on here. I'm going to hold out a little longer. And as soon as that happens, that's where your runaway comes. Is that this year? I don't know. Is it next year? I don't know. Is it 5 years from now? I don't know. I know that it is an inevitability. The scarcity has not been fully understood yet. This is why you should still be stacking as much as you can whenever you can. And not worrying about the price, and not worrying about what it does next week. Not worrying about what it does next month. Not worrying about the big retractions. This is happening. It's in full view now. It's up to you what you do with it. Now, this led to all this talk has led to some questions like, would a return to hard money lead back to like this beautiful architecture I've talked about? Like if you walk around Manhattan Island and you start looking at some of the churches and buildings that were built like in the mid to late 1800s and early 1900s when we were on a gold standard, and you look at the beauty of that architecture. There's one church in particular, the sculptures on it, like each square yard is a work of art that belongs in a museum. I can't remember the name of the church, but it is like when you look at it, you just sit there and you're just absolutely awe-inspired by its beauty. I think that it would, and I think my next question about this helps to answer it. How quickly, I don't know. Is it what we're heading to? I find it, at least in the next decade even, doubtful. I think there's a long road of Bitcoin adoption before it becomes a monetary base at a global level, which is what it takes for that to happen. I think we're going to have a coexistence, and it might be the first time in history, really, that we've had a coexistence of a absolute scarce hard money as a saving vehicle, as a monetary storage vehicle, as a store of value, and a means of exchange when it's warranted to do so, and a currency-based, fiat currency-based economy of an inflationary currency that serves the lending markets, and it doesn't really fix all the fiat shit. It's just you have this, you have an alternative, you have an opt-out. And I think that's got a long bit of wind in it. I also think that the day that it actually hits and governments go, fuck, we have to do it. Like, I think that can happen gradually then suddenly, right? In the words of Ernest Hemingway and Parker Lewis, right? Gradually then suddenly. It'll seem like it happened instantly, but there'll be a long run up to it. And I could be wrong. It could happen next year. I'm not going to bet on that. I'm the long-term strategist. Keep stacking, keep stacking, keep stacking. $5 a day, $10 a day, DCA every day. That is the way. That's what I'm kind of teaching people to do now, because the days of being able to do, large buys for people like us and get significant Bitcoin with it are kind of faded. When I think we will soon be back over 100K. I don't know what our retraction zone will be, what our accumulation trough in the next cycle will be. Are we going to break that? I have no idea. But I think the days of like us building big, beautiful architecture again and thinking the way that we should be under hard money, I don't think that necessarily, at least all the way, happens soon. It will take time. So that brings me to a question I get all the time. Well, then how would lending work in a hard money environment? It's not hard to understand at all right now why, somebody would loan you money to buy a house at 5% and why you would borrow money at 5% to buy a house. You're borrowing a inflationary currency to purchase an inflationary or a deflationary asset, right? Your house, if you take care of it, will be worth more money tomorrow. And most people that buy houses that take care of them and hold them for more than 5 years, they were ahead by taking a mortgage versus losing the money, because you should be able to make more on your money through even conventional investments than the cost of borrowing money to buy a house, right? And you can also see why somebody would invest in a company. You're taking, again, a currency that's going to lose value, and I'm putting it into a company that hopefully is going to gain value. And I don't, but I'm also like, what are today's investors looking for? They're looking at most a couple quarters out. They're not looking at what's this company going to be worth in 10 years, let alone 20, let alone 50. So when you move to a hard currency, you change your time preference from a short time preference to a long time preference. So that's why we had the big, beautiful buildings. If you look at some of the churches, for instance, built in Europe under hard money, like Notre Dame and what have you, like these are places that are still iconic half a millennia after they were built. The vision required to build something that's going to be around in 100, 200, 300 years and to see that your investment will benefit you in your lifetime, but it will never benefit you the way that the quick money casino would. But if you have a share in it, it's benefiting your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren, your great-great-grandchildren. No matter what we do with longevity, you'll never know. That's a different mindset, and it comes from hard money. And that means, do you see this stupid question? I'm not even going to answer it. I'm not even going to tell the people on the audio what it is. It's so moronically, the way it's even asked, it shows an ignorance into what I say and what I believe. So F off. Anyway, it's going to take a long time for that. But you're going to have to convince an investor that their return will be better than the appreciation value of the asset they're investing with. So if I'm going to invest gold or Bitcoin, I have to believe that you are going to outperform the baseline of the investment at first. And so do you. Because it's easy to borrow money when you know that I'm going to be paying the loan back with cheaper money in the future. In other words, if you just look back, like when I bought my first vehicle, brand new vehicle, like go in, fill out a credit application and buy a vehicle, I bought a Nissan hard body pickup, I guess about 1994, and I think I paid about $12,000 for it. Now think about that in today's money. It's just ridiculous. And I know it sounds like to younger people, like 1994, right? Like it really isn't that long ago. That's how quick it eroded. But where you really see it is when you're buying something that's an appreciating asset. My father-in-law, at the time he was, we needed to put him in elder care and we were selling his home. His house payment was $219 all in, $219. That the only thing that didn't cover was his taxes, right? He had to pay his taxes separately. That's just how he did things. But his interest, all that on the house is $219. It was a nice little 3-bedroom house sitting on about 0.15 acres in a nice suburb because he had been in it that long. So you can understand why you would borrow money in that environment because the money becomes cheaper that you're paying back. When you're borrowing money that's going to appreciate in value, against an asset that's appreciating in value, you got to believe they're at least going to lockstep with each other or that what you're buying will outperform it. And that's how an investor looks at it. Now, here's the issue that why people have a hard time grokking this, okay? We're still pricing Bitcoin in dollars. To get to this world people are talking about, that would stop. Or the dollar would be backed by Bitcoin. It would be a fraction of Bitcoin. By the time you get there, when you diffuse out the economic energy as a base monetary instrument, yes, its value will increase over time, but you're talking 2-4% a year. You're not talking like these tremendous run-ups where we have 50%, you know, in a four-year cycle, even with a downside, your compounded growth rate being 20, 25, 30, 40% per annum. That's appreciating against money that we're printing and money that other governments are printing. What you want to know is when you becomes a base unit, like what does it cost me to buy this microphone in Satoshis? And when you get there, that's where you stop having this massive like run up of volatility. If we're all talking volatility, if we didn't have volatility in Bitcoin, nobody would be interested in it because the volatility is how people are acquiring wealth with it. It would have to transition at some point from being a wealth acquisition asset to a wealth preservation asset. So like this is some people don't understand. Like the value of your dollar fluctuates freaking all day long, every day. You just don't really worry about it. You call it inflation or you call it price dropping, right? And most of the time you don't even really know what's causing the up and down. But there's not just currency strength, there's relative currency strength. And there's competitive currency strength. So if our dollar goes up in value against somebody we import from, then it's cheaper to import. It looks to you like prices went down when all that really happened is fiat A fell in relationship to fiat B. That's it. So that would all have to go away. And that's not something that's going to, I think, happen anytime really soon. I don't think you should put it in your planning. Let's move on to other topics so this doesn't become a full Bitcoin episode. About half Bitcoin, half other subjects was my goal today. I think we'll be more like one-third Bitcoin. We'll probably go an hour and a half, so two-thirds other subjects. But the hard money discussion is really, again, it's not a Bitcoin discussion. It could be done with gold. It could be done with silver, though it's a less anchored asset. There's a lot more silver in the world than gold. But you couldn't do it with silver or gold without a third party being involved. And that's one more thing I want to say about Bitcoin before we go. There's this whole like utopia bullshit that especially people that are of like the Bitcoin Cash world and shit, that everything with Bitcoin has to be no third party. And most of those assholes don't even run a node, so they don't even run no third party now. They don't even understand that, right? If you're not running your own node, you're relying on somebody else's node, that's a third party. You can trust it, but it is a third party. It's not full self-sovereignty. It doesn't mean you should go out and start running a node tomorrow. Just it is what it is. But you could do this with any hard money, and you end up in the same situation. Some limit on the ability of the printer to go burr. Only thing you can do when you're on a hard money is fractionalize. The problem with silver and gold is they're heavy, they're dense, they're metal, right? They're metals. And so I can't send the metal to Tokyo cheaply. For all the talk about Bitcoin fees, I can send $1 million worth of Bitcoin to Tokyo very cheaply. And it's just as cheap to send it to Miami or Chicago or Buenos Aires or Sydney. It's the same cost no matter where it is. It's weightless. It's programmable money. And so it's a better hard money system. But any hard money would create the same investment and lending environment. And so when people say, well, it can't work, well, it did. That's what to understand. We've had credit and creditors and lenders and debtors for as long as we've had money. That's why you go back and you read in the Bible about not using usurious interest rates, right, as one of the commandments of God. That's how ancient lending is. So they were using metal back then. They were using hard money back then. So we can adapt to it. All right, let's talk about mushrooms. I found this to be a sadly somewhat humorous question. Let me find it here real quick so I'm reading it. Okay, this comes from Jerry. Jerry says, I just listened to your interview with Olga from Mushroom Mountain, and it sounded like this is doable. Growing, and he wanted to know, can he grow and eat King Strophoria mushrooms in his compost pile? Strophoria, based on my conversation with her, may not be the best trait, but the question will be answered the same anyway. You need to do what I do and use a heavy wood chip cap because Strophoria needs wood chips. It needs wood to grow. Other mushrooms like oysters will grow on straw. They'll grow on freaking cardboard. So you need a lot of woody material to make a good result from King Strophoria. Anyway, growing up, I used to mushroom hunt all the time with my old man here in Southeast Michigan. The old man had one rule. If a mushroom was pink underneath, it's safe to eat. Right there, I was like, I can see where this is going, and it ain't good. I'm glad his dad didn't die from this, okay? That is not a rule. That is not how you do mushrooming. I'm sorry. Fortunately for me, I found mushrooms gross and would not eat them at the time. One evening, my old man ate a bunch of mushrooms we just picked the day before with a steak. 15 minutes later, he was sick as a dog, barfing like a heroin addict going through withdrawals, and the amber lamps was called. Some of you know the breadcrumb he planted with amber lamps. If you don't, it's up to you to find out if you want to know. Long, short story, mushrooms almost killed him. Pretty traumatic experience for a 12-year-old boy. Thankfully, no one else ate any of them, and he made a full recovery and never ate a mushroom, never to mushroom hunt again. So as you can understand, I'm a bit gun-shy here. I will eat the shit out of store-bought mushrooms now. Thanks for a great show and a way cool interview. I'm looking forward to the next interview with Olga. Thanks, Jerry. I am too. I need to reach out to her today and remind her, hey, fill out the form again and get on the show again. I really want to talk to her about the medicinal side of mushrooms as well. So first of all, it falls right in with what I've said before about mushrooms and eating mushrooms. Do not, under any circumstances, harvest any mushroom that you are not 100% sure of, and having a blanket rule like if the fins are this way or if the size is no smaller than but no larger than or any other bullshit people have to say about mushrooms, don't. There are mushrooms that are actually safe to eat or can kill you based on what you consume with them. some of the LBMs. Those are the ones that spontaneously pop up in your compost pile. I don't know which ones, so don't eat any of them unless you're an expert. And then you know, probably not listening to my advice on mushrooms. Some of them are perfectly safe to eat, unless you consume them in combination with alcohol, in which case they turn toxic and can fucking kill you. You don't mess around here. However, the basis of the question, if I buy spawn and inoculate a thing, whether it's a compost pile, a wood chip pile, a garden bed, a straw bale, whatever, is it safe to eat the mushrooms I cultivate? Absolutely. And it will narrow down your need for expertise. If you buy King Strophoria spawn, all you have to know is how to identify King Strophoria. What pops up there will probably be King Strophoria. Not much else looks like King Strophoria. There is one sort of kind of lookalike. So you would look up on the internet, King Strophoria mushroom lookalike, find out the defining characteristics of that, and that's all the determination you would have to make. It's kind of like being in the United States and you're out in the woods somewhere and you see a snake. You don't have to, you know, if you're in South Florida where all kinds of shit's escaped into the Everglades, this is out. But if you're in, let's say, the swamps of Pennsylvania, you know, there you only have a couple snakes you need to know how to identify. But throughout the United States, you basically need to know what a coral snake is, what a rattlesnake is, and there's many species, but what a rattlesnake is, what a copperhead is, and what a cottonmouth or water moccasin is. If you know those four, that's all that it can be, and anything else by default is non-venomous. That's how you can look at cultivating your mushrooms this way. You also can cultivate indoors on medium that you have at least sanitized, if not sterilized, using something like hot water, so not much else is going to grow. And when you see great big oyster-shaped, you know, mushroom set of bluish mushroom, and you did blue oyster mushroom, you're pretty good to go now, right? Where it gets dangerous is what this guy and his dad were doing when you're going out and you're foraging for mushrooms in the wild. You can find things that look similar to something that's edible, and you don't really know what you're looking at. Morals, there's also false morals. They're actually pretty easy to differentiate if you know how to do so. And if you go into any like the mushroom groups on Facebook or whatever, you post a picture of a mushroom and you say, "What is this?" There's very informed people there, and you're going to get things like, well, you need to do a spore test. I need to see what color the spores are on this paper and stuff like that. There's a reason. If it's not easily identifiable, they don't want to tell you something that it isn't. So when you're foraging, you need the expertise, or you need somebody with the expertise. If somebody says all mushrooms that are safe, I don't care what the blank is, unless all mushrooms that are King Strophoria are safe, all mushrooms that are lion's mane are safe. If it's all mushrooms, insert characteristics here, are safe, the person does not have the expertise to trust. No disrespect to this guy's dad. No, it's not that. It's just that if somebody tells you that, don't listen to them. And it's only a matter of time before something like this happens, or worse. It will happen, okay? Next up, this was another interesting one. Again, I've got this telegrammed it to myself so I could read it. I found this one really interesting. This is from Greg. Greg says, any suggestions for a mulch pile that keeps spontaneously igniting? My neighbor has been letting various tree and lawn services drop their mulch at the back of his property near my fence. Not sure if he got the idea from you or not. The fire department has been out three times since last night due to large amounts of smoke pouring out. One firefighter said to call as soon as we see smoke. Another said only call if there's actively flames. My thoughts are to ask the neighbor to spread out the mulch now so it doesn't combust. The pile's about 6 feet high. Yeah, that's a problem. And it has a 10 by 10 yard footprint. That's a lot of freaking wood chips. We are in Central Texas. While we had enough moisture for burn ban to be lifted, I'm not crazy about the potential for flare-up. And if the wind shifts, we'll have smoke constantly hitting our back patio. The guy's a good neighbor. He's planning on spreading the mulch all over the area. He just has graded. It's 1.5 acres. It also seems that the fire department constantly dousing it with water actually aiding the process in the long haul. Thanks, Greg. Now, you might be thinking, how would adding water aid the process? Yeah, it is exactly what it's doing. The solution here is that pile needs to be spread out and needs to be no more absolutely no more than 3 foot high. So 2 foot six would be a better number because people tend to not actually aim for the right mark when doing this. And as they continue to bring the wood chips in, if he needs to store them long term, then more of a windrow or kind of staggered out arrangement needs to be done. It's the pressure of that much. That's a lot of volume. 6 foot tall of wood chips pressing down. These are perennial wood chips, which means they are from prunings and stuff, which means they have green and brown. What do you get with green and brown? You get compost. But what is the one other thing that we need to add to greens and browns to get reliable composting, to get that process going of the bacteria breaking it down really rapidly and generating heat in a thermal cycle? And people would say oxygen. Well, oxygen is important. Wood chips are pretty fluffy. There's lots of oxygen flowing through there. But even anaerobes will produce heat. Just because your compost pile is hot doesn't mean you don't have anaerobes. Now, they're less tolerant of certain temperatures, right? But that's not really – it's water. It's water. So you bring all this stuff in. It's naturally going to start composting some, but we've had a lot of rain in Texas this year. And so that's water. And the fire department comes in, puts more water on it. And what happens? More water goes in. It temporarily shuts down the combustion, and it temporarily drops the temperature, but it further wets the pile. It further increases the thermophilic activity. And as the outside of the pile is drying and the inside's wet, and I have the heat here and up where I can get more oxygen in for a flame eventually, I've got dry. So I got the sun beating down on the top, drying it out. I got heat coming up from below. And we can get into, with a big pile like that, temperatures 180, 190, 200 degrees. And then pockets can get higher. And then things get together just right. And then all of a sudden, smoke. Now, are you actually getting smoke or are you getting steam? We've had some cool days in Texas this year as well, going pretty late into the year. I did some recent composting, and when I walked out about 4 days later, it was cool enough in the morning, steam was pouring off of it. But I'm betting, since the fire department says it, and because you said it's 6 foot tall, that's what's happening. So this is something you guys need to know. They really do not need to be 6 foot tall. It's not always going to happen, and it has a lot to do with the material. If the person that's dropping the chips is primarily removing dead trees and there's very little leaf in them, or if it's being done mostly in the dormant period where the trees have dropped their sap and the leaves have fallen off, you're going to get a lot less likelihood of this. But this time of year, when everything's like, it's spring, it's time to spring, let's go. And most of these guys are probably pruning shit off of like around power lines and stuff, so the power doesn't go out like mine almost did today. Yeah. You're going to get compost, and then you're going to get heat. And so you really need to think about it, how you store it, and you need to keep an eye on it, and you need to have a plan, man, for what to do if this happens. Because, you know, it could just dry up right about the right time and still be wet inside, and you could have a big, big, big problem. So that's something to know. Next up, I had a question on bone char. Bone char, I had an answer for. I had to do a little research for you on the second question this individual asked. But basically said, is there anything special I need to do to make bone char? And they also have, for some reason, a lot of clamshells. And they wanted to know if they can do the same thing and make, basically, I guess they thought they could make bone char out of clamshells because clamshells are like similar to bone. They're not. So let's start with the clamshells and why this is not a good idea. Clamshell is mostly lime. It's not really carbon-based. A bone is carbon-based. A bone is part of your living organism. A shell on something like a clam, like if you chip off the outside of the shell of a clam, it doesn't hurt it. It doesn't feel pain because you chipped a piece of the shell off. If you chip the shell of a turtle, it hurts. Like the turtle's shell, even though it's hard, is part of its body, right? It's not living inside of it the way we think of it. It's attached to it. It has nerves and blood vessels in its shell. A clam really is creating the shell around, bivalve like that, creating the shell around it through calcium deposition. So what happens when you char calcium? Well, eventually you basically may, I think it's called quicklime. It's something like that. It's you'll drive off the CO2 in it. So there is carbon in it, but it's mostly in the form of CO2. And that means you're going to end up basically making quicklime. So it's really not a good product. It can be caustic. It's CaO is what you're making, and it's not great for soil unless you know exactly what you're doing and why you're doing it. There can be some soil amendment steps that you take from that. Bone char. So the thing about bone char is it's best done as some form of retort. So you might do something like a can full of bones into a fire with some holes to let the gases out. If you're trying to do it with like an open burn, like a kiln burn, then there is a point if you've done open kiln burns, like a Weber kettle, like a biochar kiln, like one made with a 55-gallon drum either cut in half or cut sideways or something like that. It's about midpoint that things get really going and really hot. That would be where you'd want to add your bones because they're going to have more time to char even as you're adding more layers with that residual heat in there because they just take longer to char. So you can do it, but those are the aspects you want to look at. Like a really great way to make bone char might be instead of making, if you're an open burn person like I am, I don't do a lot with retorts, is to make smaller retorts for the bones. And when you're having a campfire in the backyard or something, throw it in there. And if it doesn't fully char, just set it aside and pitch it back in during your next burn. Or if you're doing some sort of like a barrel burn, like one of like the Tila designs that really isn't a retort, you could maybe take something like a hotel tray full of bones and put it in there along with your other material, and that may work well for you as well, but I haven't tried that. I've not been big into making bone char. It is a useful soil amendment. It's also good as a deer repellent to make bone sauce with. And if you want to know more about that, check out Billy Bond's YouTube channel. He talks about it quite a bit. Moving on. What is the deal with the $20,000 slate truck? I didn't have the website pulled up. Let me pull that up now for those that are here, so at least you can see what this thing looks like as we talk about it for a little bit anyway. So the slate is being marketed, and the person that asked the question used the price. The pre-marketing is this is a $20,000 pickup. I mean, how could you possibly not be happy with a $20,000 pickup? It's a great price. And the reality is, this thing is called the Slate, not because of its color, because there's a bunch of colors that you can make it, because it's being marketed as a blank slate. There are many options, even though they make one model. Everything else is an accessory. It could be like a surfer's truck like you're seeing here. It can basically be a five-passenger SUV, but that whole top piece is like a hard-top Jeep kind of. It just goes onto it, right? And they have, right out of the gate, 100 different accessories, a whole bunch of colors, and it's designed so you can go to the website and configure your own exactly the way you want it and have it delivered with financing options and all. But this thing's not even going to go into production until 2026. They're throwing out a price number right now of 20 grand. But let's talk about where do you get a number like 20 grand on this front. So the actual base price of the completely stripped down blank slate electric vehicle is $27,500. How do you get the 20K? Well, they say if the person's income is just the right sweet spot, and then they use the government rebates and what have you for taxes, then what will it really cost them? $20,000. We'll put that number on it. That's the best case scenario. And that's all the rebates staying at least as good as they are right now until you can actually buy one in, let's say, for real, not 2026, 2027. And that's with the price of all the shit they're going to build it out of not going up over the next 2 years. Okay, right? And that's the most blank motherfucking thing you can get. Here's what's good about this truck. Forget that it's an EV. It is a truck about the size of like a Toyota smaller pickup truck from the late 80s, mid 90s. Something like about the size of the Nissan pickup that I said I bought as my first truck, even though that was an extend cab and this would not be. Right. a truck analogous, maybe a little bit bigger than like the old Ford Rangers. Standard cab, you know, no extend cab, standard bed, 6 foot bed, narrow bed compared to like a full size truck. We need that. There are no little trucks left. I mean, I have a Tacoma and it's, it is almost as big as like F-100s used to be, right? Like, or F-150s used to be. Like, it's about the size of like when Dodge first came out with a smaller pickup, like the Dakota, right? Was it the Dakota? Whatever it was. You guys know what I mean. They had that compact pickup that wasn't really compact. And that's when everybody else started making their little trucks bigger and their bigger trucks ginormous. So that's good. It is affordable. But how affordable is it going to be when you buy all the shit you want to make it into what you want? It doesn't even come with a fucking radio or speakers in it, though they are available as accessories. It comes with like a dock for like your iPhone or your Android phone or whatever, which to be fair is about all you need anymore. But if you want even speakers in it, you need that. If you want heated seats in it, well, they have heated seat covers that plug in. So they'll warm you, but if, you know, you can take them out in the summer. Okay, that's cool. You can get them later if you want to. I get it, but this is like a nickel and dime truck. And by the time you're done being nickel and dime, it turns into real money. And I don't see for a minute this truck costing $27,500 when it becomes available in 2027. You may be able to reserve one now and lock a price in, but that's not even, right? That's not even. Oh, I didn't notice that, but he's right. Zone 6 Eric says, Slate is a Tesla anagram. Coincidentally? I don't know. I bet you their marketing department figured it out. But I think the whole blank slate is their marketing. Maybe that's how they came to it. And then this is how we'll market it. But that's how their marketing is. Like, they're all the same, but yours can be unique and individual to you. All you got to do is point click buy it on a website. Very similar to Tesla. Very similar to everybody now. Here's the issue with this truck. Let's say you built this truck, and it is being built in America, in Indiana. You built this exact truck. You put a decent four-cylinder motor in it. You should probably be able to build this truck for about $18,000 actual sale price. Why does somebody build that? With an internal combustion engine. Extremely efficient. Probably more power, because what this ain't is a Cybertruck. This ain't got the power of a Tesla, even though it is an anagram. There's another side to it too. Well, $27,000, what does that get you? That gets you the most basic battery package, which doesn't give you a great amount of range. And even the more expensive battery package, the range is not equivalent to, let's say, a Tesla. You know, you're looking at about 250 miles of range in it. A nice thing, you can plug it in to a standard wall outlet. You don't need a special charger. Yeah, but everything has a trade-off. You plug it into a standard wall outlet about once an hour, you add about 1 to 3 miles of range to the vehicle. So overnight, unless you work across the street, you're not going anywhere. You get a relatively decent charge rate with a simple 240 outlet, like you plug a dryer into or a stove, an electric stove. So that's not that expensive to have installed. And you could have that done, and it will charge in 30 minutes with a public charger, the big giant ones like they put in parking lots and stuff like that. So it's about roughly equivalent to what other vehicles charge with, but at that charging time, you're still not getting the range that you would get out of like a Model 6. So what do I think? I don't think it's going to do that well. I could be wrong, though. I don't know. I'm not lining up to buy one. I think you're looking at a vehicle that's still going to be in like, with most basic options added to it in a $35,000 range. And I think that leaves a gaping hole in the market for people to come into the market with something like this that uses, you know, an internal combustion engine, actually comes with a decent sound system. It doesn't even have electric windows, for fuck's sake. Right? I mean, and I know I want the old trucks back. Yeah, sure you do. Sure you do. The ones that are on the side of the road rusted. Sure you do. Sure you do. Okay. Like, and I know when electric windows first came out, there were some quirks and all with them. I had a 75 model car with electric windows. That's what I meant by first came out. There were times I had to like hold the window button and slam the door to make it go. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. We don't really have those problems anymore. As far as like all the cool shit that Tesla can do with self-driving and all, this thing's not going to have that. Unless it's like a $50,000 module to plug into it someday or something like that. So I don't know. I really think that the market that's existing right now in America is a standard cab, smaller truck for about $20,000. And I think it's doable. And it will have more power, more range, and cost less to do with a gas motor. Electric vehicles are an idea that I want to like more than I do, to be blunt, to be honest. We're going to get to it later in the show today. We don't have the energy for this. That's just the reality. We do not have enough energy generation capacity for this and many other things that are happening with the reindustrialization of the country. We don't have enough copper to put in the energy generation capacity without massive clearance for putting in a ton of new power generation, and much of it needs to be nuclear. We can't do this. We can't do this. It will stay a niche product, which means, you know, 10% of the fleet maybe is still pretty niche for the automotive industry until we can solve that problem. And it doesn't seem like we're on track to solve that problem. Like, the AI data centers are going to eat the power as quick as we can add it, and there's not even enough for them. And that's not going to slow down at all. That will take precedence over your electric vehicle. I know some people don't want to hear me say that, but it's the truth. And the only thing holding it back, well, there's two main things holding back. The regulatory environment that makes it so expensive to do, and the power generation capacity. If you solve those two, electric vehicles become superior to gas vehicles in almost every way, because they should have massive longevity in comparison. You got to solve the battery longevity issue too, but a lot of work has gone into that. The battery systems that are going into these vehicles today are far superior than what was going into them even 5 years ago. Anyway, let's continue on. Basically, don't get too jazzed up about it. You know, we'll see. I don't expect that price to even. Remember when the Cybertruck initially dropped as a concept? They were talking about selling them for $37,000. How'd that work out? All right, so moving on. I got a very heartfelt email. I think I dropped it in a Telegram so that I could read it. If not, I'll just give you the gist of it. Okay. Love your show, Jack. Have you addressed, or will you address, the idea of responsibility to care for your neighbor when times get tough? I'm not a socialist. You don't have to be, but struggle with ethical responsibility of taking care of the downtrodden in times of trouble. I even have trouble defining downtrodden due to the abuse of the welfare state. I realize we're each responsible for taking care of our own. I struggle with setting the threshold for giving away my hard-fought resources when such a crisis arises, not to mention the OPSEC breach when more and more come knocking, when the word gets out. Would love some of your resources. Would love some of your resources for your stance on whatever that is. Thanks for the help. Okay, so first of all, we have a person here that's like on the edge of the dark space, right? The dark place. That they're worried that like the world's going to end. We're going to have like the apocalyptic shutdown type scenario and what have you. And while that is a possibility, it is a low probability. So first of all, I think you're actually concerned about situation that's far less likely to happen than you believe it to be. I know I'm the survival guy, and I should be telling you, get your beans, your bullets, your band-aids, get your bunker, and fuck those people, and shoot them if they come take your shit. Like, this is not reality. And all we have to do is look at where have massive breakdowns in society happened, and what did they look like? And they've never looked like a TV movie yet. You know, probably the worst-case scenario was Bosnia and Herzegovina. And we were so insulated from that, we thought it was just American planes dropping some bombs and then some shit. Like, that shit went on for over a year, and it was bad. It was neighbors raping other neighbors so that the neighbors on their side wouldn't think that they were on the other side and hurt them. And I actually had someone who lived through it on the show many years ago to talk about that and other horrible things that came from it. And you know what it still wasn't? It still wasn't everybody running around in hordes stealing everything. And the people that did some of that, when the crisis ended, they just disappeared, and it turned out no one bothered to look for them. Bill, I don't know, he's gone, he left. Well, Bill, you mean the asshole that stole the old lady's shit down the road? I don't know, like, when the whole thing ended, he just left. Where'd he go? I don't know. Yeah, we really don't give a fuck where he went, and you know where Bill went. Bill went in a hole. The people that did that shit, is it kind of like began to settle back down and they tried to go back to living their normal life, you know, a couple of people showed up and just, hey, Bill, guess where you're going? In that hole. Goodbye, bitch. That's what happened. So do you want to be Bill in that scenario? No. No, what happened very quickly is people started working together. So why should you do some level of helping your neighbors? And when you say your neighbors, I'm talking about like people you look out your window and see their homes around you. Okay. Why should you be some level of helpful to them? Because if your neighborhood's not safe and secure, you're not. You understand that? You're not. I don't care how much shit you have. If your neighborhood is going into complete decay, you're not safe. No matter how much shit you have. And if you are there and you know, you exist, it's going to become real evident that you have stuff. It's easier to feed your neighbors than to shoot them. So there's a moral responsibility. There's also just a logistical reality that if you're actually concerned with preparedness, you should be working to some level of stability in advance. And as decay begins to happen, trying to like backfeed in some stability to this, I don't think you should be running around going, hey, you should all have like 2 years worth of food in your basement like I do. That will make you a target at some point. Maybe even when nothing goes wrong. Hey, he's got a lot of shit. Right? The meth heads down the road find out you have a lot of shit. Hey, he's a good, like, he went on vacation. Maybe we should steal his shit. Instead of worrying about, like, telling people too much, because when the shit is the fan, they're going to take your stuff. People steal shit every day. So I think the reality is you can't feed your entire neighborhood anyway. But what you can do is you can help the people adjacent to you at least, and you can build a consortium of people willing to look out for each other. And that's always the people that make it through this shit. That's always what they do. So that should be your plan. There's no way you can store enough food to feed your neighborhood for a week, let alone a month, let alone a year. I don't care how much money you have. You don't have the space. You know, if you think you can feed people, like large group of people long term, all you got to do, get in the event business like I'm in. Run a workshop for 75 people for 4 days and see how much food you go through in 4 days. Now, think about a neighborhood, you know, even a block with about the same amount of people on it. You're trying to feed those people and their kids for what? A month? You ain't going to do it. It's not going to happen. So I think that this is one of those concerns that should be approached from a different mindset. Like the mindset that this guy's coming at it from just doesn't work against reality. You're not going to have zombie hordes of bikers driving around like a James Wesley Walls novel, stealing everything from every house they go through. And if you do, you better have your neighborhood secure. So it ain't going to happen, but if it does happen, the only solution is to build a consortium of defense amongst your neighbors. So what do? You do what you always do. You prep. You look out for people. You figure out what you can do to best help your neighbors now. And that's probably not giving them shit. You know, it's things like finding out the old lady next to you, the reason that like her whole place is unkempt is she can't do it anymore, and you help fix a few things up for her. And then you find out, well, you know, the thing is, she's doing okay. She has enough money to buy groceries, but she only gets to the grocery store like once a week because she's old and she's afraid to drive anymore. And then maybe what you do is say, hey, you know what? We go to the market once every 2 weeks. If you'll give us a list of things, we'll bring stuff back for you. You pay us for it. Like, that is how you build relationships. That's how you build trust. Because I'm one of these people, I'll just shoot anybody. You're going to shoot the old lady that watches your kids when you go out with your wife that babysits for you? Or are you going to let her starve after you trust? Like, it's just nonsensical bullshit. But I feel like every time I get this question, somebody just got on a forum or a Facebook group or something and got shock and awe from the people that think it's going to be just like a book they read. It is never going to be just like a book you read if it's the kind of book that we're talking about. It's never going to be just like a movie you watched if it's the kind of movie we're talking about, because it never has been. In the worst situations, in Argentina, listen to Fernando Aguirre. In Argentina, it wasn't that way. And it was about as bad. In Venezuela right now, it's not that way. And it's about as bad as it gets, historically speaking. I'd be much more worried about like full-on warfare, which is in the low probability category where you're getting bombed and shit. But again, go look. If you don't get bombed out, generally speaking, people work together to pool resources. And the people that think they can go it alone, they end up realizing they can't, and then they have a come to Jesus moment. Or they end up ostracized and they disappear at some point, if you catch my drift. All right. Moving on now, let's talk about the rare earth deal in Ukraine. So Trump wrapped up a deal with Zelensky, and really Zelensky's government, that says we have a 50% claim along with a responsibility, because we have a 50% claim, to help Ukraine, after the war is over, develop its rare earth resources. There's also a peace deal on the table, and all the news outlets keep saying the same stupid shit. Well, the peace deal's there. It's up to Putin now. Well, when the peace deal is, hey, we want all our shit back, and Russia just fought a war because of all the shit that went on, you ain't getting it back. But there actually is a backdoor peace deal out right now that says, yeah, Russia, you keep the Donbass. Yeah, the few idiots running around in Kursk that are still there, the guerrilla forces, they'll leave. And no security guarantees for Ukraine. And no NATO for Ukraine. Possibility of EU, yes. Possibility of NATO, the door closes. Okay. With that, if that's really real, then the people holding up the deal are not Putin and Russia, it's Ukraine. But one thing Ukraine really wants is some sort of protection agreement. Like, if we're not going to be in NATO, and the mean Russians might come back and take the rest of our country, which, trust me, if Russia wanted the rest of Ukraine, they already would have taken it. They can. They've chosen not to. They took the region that was the problem. They took the region that's 94% ethnically Russian. They took the region that willingly wants to become part of the Russian Federation. It's not going to be hard for them to run a government there because the people that live there want to be part of Russia. I know the TV said that's not true. The TV lied. Shockingly, I know. Like, the TV never lies. It lied about this extensively. Please cure your Gelman amnesia. The people that told you that staying 6 feet away, somebody would stop the spread of a viral disease. The people that told you we needed to be locked in our homes, okay, over a viral disease that didn't contain at all. The people that told you a mask that says it doesn't protect you did protect you. The people that told you all that, they're the same ones that are telling you what's going on in Ukraine. In the words of Michael Crichton, you forgot what you remembered. You cannot trust these people. You cannot trust the source. This is what's going on. Now, here's the deal, though. So what this means is, you know, companies like BlackRock will finance it, and companies like Brown and Root will go in and do the work. And we're going to have a major U.S. presence on the ground in Ukraine from a commercial standpoint, doing things like extracting rare earth elements and metals that we desperately need, which is why Trump wanted the deal so bad. So with that alone, you get security assurances. Because once the United States sticks its meat hooks into something like that, all of a sudden, y'all need some more freedom. We're here to provide it, which means we own your ass now. Which means that the Ukrainian government can say, you know, if there's U.S. contractors on the ground extracting lithium, we're probably not going to have any problems from Putin and Russia. That's why it will bring the war to an end relatively quickly. Now, relatively quickly for a war is 6 months. But it has to happen, and there's a reason. Number one, we're going to start producing more oil than ever before very, very soon. And this is going to put the squeeze on the price. And that's going to suppress oil down into the 60s, low 60s, maybe even high 50s. And Russia starts to go bankrupt at about $60 a barrel. And Russia is fiscally fucked at 50. U.S. companies are miserable but can survive it. Some of the small independents go out of business, but all the big oil extraction companies are fine at 50 for a time. Russia is duck shit at 50. So they're going to put the squeeze on Russia, not with sanctions, like not with tough talk, not with threats, because that doesn't work with Putin. They're going to put the squeeze on Russia from a economic standpoint, like, would you like us to curtail production a little bit? Because we want to, too. We and Russia both love oil at about 70 bucks. Our oil companies make lots of money. The economy works at 70 bucks. Fuel's affordable, $65 to $75. It works all day long. Lower problems, higher problems. So we actually want what Russia wants, but we can endure it longer than them, just like a trade warfare with tariffs, right? Ukraine is fucked from a manpower standpoint. I'm sorry. You remember they told you that Russia was literally running out of bullets like 2.5 years ago, and apparently they still have plenty of bullets, right? They said they were taking washing machines apart to fix tanks. That was a lie. Gelman amnesia, right? All that shit. You know what Ukraine's running out of? People. They want to lower the draft age to below 18. They're already drafting people in their 60s. Russia has a lot more people than Ukraine has. And the people that you're drafting at this point are risking their lives to avoid the draft. They're being shot trying to escape their own country. They're being beat up and thrown in the back of vans. How hard do you think they're going to fight once they're conscripted against their will like that and put out on the battlefield? And I tell you what Russia is doing. If you surrender, you'll be treated well. How quick do you think people like that are to surrender? This is not the Vietnam draft in America. This is not get a letter in the mail, go to war, go to jail. And there are ways to avoid this. Like when we had the draft, if you ran a candidate or whatever, it might have hurt you in some way. But nobody was driving around in vehicles in 1968 in the United States of America and going, there's a guy, go get him. And then like, two dudes jump out and grab you and throw you in a van and take you off to war. Like, no. That is the state that this country is in right now. So both countries are reaching a point where they have to make a deal. And that is by design. Again, with economics and oil production on Russia and driving the cost of oil down, right? And then it is on Ukraine with a natural result of very poor policy. And Ukraine started this conflict, folks. I don't care what the TV told you. Ukraine conducted an illegal war against their own people for 8 years after the United States overthrew an election during the Color Revolution. They ignored their own agreements from the Minsk Accords, and they conducted an active war on the Russian border for 8 years. And then we started talking about putting Ukraine into NATO and fucking Putin, and the Russian parliament said, that's enough. That's enough. Now, if you can't accept that, then you are not using logic. Because if you fact check everything I just told you, you'll find that the story from my angle actually gets worse in the things that we did and the Ukrainian government did. And the Ukraine is not a fucking democracy. And anybody that says that should be immediately written off. I'm not being a bad person, just being uninformed. Ukraine is not a democracy. It is a full-on oligarchy. It makes the United States look like a fucking utopia. The corruption is one of the most corrupt nations on the, especially developed nations, one of the most corrupt nations in the world from a governmental corruption standpoint. They make Chicago look legit. The Chicago government looks legit compared to the Ukrainian government. Your money has not been funding what you think it has. Some of the things your money that's been sent to Ukraine are funding includes like the retirement accounts of Ukrainian retired bureaucrats. You've been funding their 401ks, basically. Good job, America. Anyway, moving on. That will end the war relatively short term. Like there's just only so much that can continue to go on from both sides. Russia economically, Ukraine from a manpower standpoint. And for all the talk, Europe's going to get involved. We're going to send, no, they're not. No, they're not. No one is going to fucking send any troops into that goddamn meat grinder. I'm sorry. It's not happening. So let's talk about our biggest problem with this new golden age, with the reindustrialization of America. Let's talk about what is our big problem. We don't have the stuff. All the policy that's being rolled out is geared toward turning production back on in America, building giant AI data centers. The Trump administration, love or hate Orange Man, in their first 100 days, did something that's never been done before. They got an $8 trillion economic stimulus package done without Congress and zero American tax dollars being spent. That is the amount that all the companies together that have pledged new construction and development of factories and plants and facilities in the United States have pledged to spend. $8 trillion in a fucking quarter. In a quarter. Q1 2025, $8 trillion of pledged investment. If half of it doesn't happen, it's the biggest one quarter infusion of investment capital pledge in history at $4 trillion. Nothing like this has ever happened before. Again, you can hate Trump, you can have Trump derangement syndrome, whatever you want, but this shit was going on and leading up to where we're headed during the Biden administration. Not because Biden, but because this is the plan for America. The industrial oligarchs have gotten together and decided if we destroy America, completely, we actually fuck ourselves in the end. We don't like being fucked in the end. We don't want that. So, but if we don't completely rebuild America, then it still falls apart and we're fucked too. So how do we fuck the average person just enough while making them just comfortable enough to get what we want? And it turns out the only real answer is to rebuild America's industrial might. That's the only way you can do it. That's why they're, it's not because they're benevolent. It's their own self-interest to do this. Like, as they look out at what's happening in China and what's happening in Europe, it's basically the rise of fascism in a way that doesn't benefit the oligarchs. It's too much control by the state. Fascism, which is what most economic systems in the world are today, they're fascist, require cooperation between government and industry. Okay? Now, if you're an industrial fascist, you want a little bit more power than the government has. So if a government becomes too totalitarian, too restrictive, too controlling, it actually doesn't benefit you anymore. Well, that's what they get out of America. They get out of America, we can rein in the government and empower industry. So that benefits them. And this all works. The trade policies of the Trump administration are not perfect, but they do send us in the direction. And that's at a macro what you need to be heading in the right direction. This infusion and this willingness of companies to say, hey, yeah, we'll build in America again. Apple will, you know, I think Apple's some ridiculous amount of money they've pledged to spend. You know, and we'll see if they do it. Like I said, even if it fails by 50%, it's still enormous. But, okay, we're going to build all these data centers. Where are you going to get the copper? Where are you going to get the copper? From China? We actually produce quite a bit of copper in America, but not enough. And how long does it take to go like, hey, we changed things, guys, mine some more copper? Well, the price of copper needs to have enough long-term stability in its value to make this tremendous investment in mining. Plus, now we need all these, you got to clear all these hurdles. Like before a chunk of copper comes out of the ground, we're talking years, not months. Now start doing it with every other thing that we need. There are so many things that we need that we just do not have in the quantity necessary for this to play out over, let's say, a four-year cycle, which is kind of the Trump gambit. And where are we going to get it? Well, a lot of it we can get from China. A lot of it is produced in Australia, but it's refined in China. We can't make antibiotics in this country, even though we say we do, because the raw materials come from China. And the one country that we have a full-on trade war with, despite all the hype about Trump's declared trade war on the whole world, is China. You see the problem. We want this. China doesn't want this. China wants to be what we say we're going to be. Now, they want to do it in full government control. China seems to be heading toward a gold-backed currency. They have a shitload of gold. It won't work. It's not going to work. It's never going to work. China has a history on economic decisions of always picking the wrong horse at the wrong time, as they did with silver when the world switched over to gold. So they didn't learn that lesson 150 years ago. Now they're going to relearn it again the hard way. But it doesn't mean they can't cause a lot of trouble for us. They could put us into a bad way right now. No antibiotics. Good luck. And a lot of other pharmaceuticals we get. Electronics, the components more than the final product. The fact that some plastic toy might become unaffordable, we'll get away with that. That's not really a problem. And if you're waiting for me to drop the foot of, well, here's how we're going to solve it, I don't know. I don't know yet. It's going to require some real finesse. Things like the deal made with Ukraine. Okay, that helps, but you still got to get the minerals extracted and refined. We have lots of deposits in the United States, but you got to get the minerals extracted and refined, which means you have to build the extraction capability and you have to build the refinement capability. It's not like you dig cadmium out of the ground in chunks of pure cadmium. Right, it has to be refined down to the base element, lithium, et cetera, all of these. And just metals like copper, iron, right, aluminum. Like, we don't have enough of this either. So we either have to develop this capability in nations that are less developed and hence less restrictive than the United States from a regulation standpoint, or we need to curtail regulations here. Now, one thing Trump is promising, build in America, we'll pull this shit out of your way fast. The one big beautiful bill, which isn't all beautiful, has provisions in it for like a company that's building a new facility, a manufacturing facility in America, pay no income tax for 10 years. I mean, all of that will work. If you don't like it, I don't care. It'll work. Here's the problem. I want to build a factory. Great. Federal government's like, we will move mountains for you. We'll make it as easy as possible. We're not going to let you like, oh, I don't know, you know, fill baby seals up with mercury and drop them out of a helicopter on people's heads. But with, you know, we will curtail a bunch of this environmental bullshit back so you can build a place. Okay, well, where do you want to build it? California. Okay, you're fucked. You're on your own. Like, you're never going to get it done. Elon Musk recently said that we built the Gigafactory in Austin in about 2 years. If I had decided to build it in California, I still wouldn't have the permitting done today. And that's a true statement. So people are going to have to be selective of where they develop. And so a lot of your big blue states, your Californias, your Oregons, your Washingtons, and most of the Northeast, they're fucked. It's not going to happen there. So you have to find the resources and the environment and the manpower and the energy and the stuff in a place with the right regulatory attitude, like Texas, like the Southeast, the greater Southeast, Mississippi, the Carolinas, Georgia, Kentucky, Tennessee. Like, these are places you can look at, and different things will work in different spaces. Southwest, you pretty much got Texas because New Mexico ain't happening. That's a great place to do it, but the regulatory framework there is worse. Arizona, we'll see. Give it 3 more years and Arizona is going to make its determination of what it's really going to be. Is it going to be a liberty-oriented state or is it going to go California itself? It hasn't really decided yet. Nevada, I don't know. There's always the federal land play. We'll give you some federal land to build your shit on. The problem is most of the federal lands aren't where there's enough of a worker base. You almost have to build a new company town. You see what I'm saying? Like, there is no way to solve this fully. Builder of castles says distributed manufacturing. Yeah, do that with a car. Do that with a data center. Do that with copper ore that needs to turn into refined copper and then needs to be made into a specific AGW of copper wire to be run in a rack in a data center, plugged into a server, doing 10,000 calculations a second. And you got to manufacture the server, the rack that's made out of steel, the overhead rack that's made out of aluminum, the heavier copper lines that runs all the DC power off the giant battery bank that's inside the data center. You're going to distributed manufacture. We already do distributed manufacture. All that shit all comes from different places, but a whole lot of it is in China. Now, ramp up the requirement without an equivalent ramp up in energy resource and raw materials, and you have a pinch point. Now, there will be ways around this in time. The reason I'm bringing it up is it might provide you the opportunity for like once-in-a-lifetime investments. If you can identify the companies that are going to solve this problem and invest in those, you may be able to make money hand over fist. I don't have a recommendation yet. And if somebody's giving you a recommendation right now, it's probably too early. This is a sector of the sector of the world to watch right now. How will we deal with the resource limitations? See, we all thought by now we'd be talking about the resource limitations in order to exist. Food and water and base energy, like to keep your house heated. What we're actually looking at is a resource shortage preventing the kind of growth that everybody's claimed they've wanted for the last 30, 40 years. You've got a president who's a Republican that other than a few places is governing a lot like a 90s Democrat. Governing a lot like Donald Trump is like somebody took Ronald Reagan on some things and Bill Clinton on other things and stuck them together. I mean, in some ways, it's the best possible stance to have right now that's doable, right? There's bad. If it was King Jack, we'd have a whole different system, okay? But we don't. Like, politics is the art of the possible. And right now, you have people shrieking about Trump being Hitler. If they understood his policies, they are in like 90% agreement with them. Working Democrats should love what he's doing. He's doing exactly what Clinton promised but didn't do. He's doing a lot of what Barack Obama promised and never did. From a trade standpoint, like, this is what your union's been telling. If you're a working class union Democrat, this is what your union's been saying we need for 40 freaking years. While America, you know, just was flushed. That's all good. But how do you build a fire without fuel? That's really the question here. And for this to happen, a lot of other things have to happen. Here's some other things that have to happen. The big, beautiful bill. Yeah, there's a bunch of bullshit in there. Will not be beautiful. But what's in there is extending the tax cuts and new tax cuts. That has to happen. You have to get regulatory shifts, and you have to get tax cuts, and then the last piece is the stuff. The first two are probably going to happen, to a degree anyway. The last one, that is a finite resource situation, and in some situations, there's not a real easy way to solve it from a standpoint of the resources themselves. But in a lot of places, it's just we are in our own way. And we haven't developed the resources for ourselves. We developed it for others and then bought from them. We need to change that. Why do you think Orange Man is so like hyped up about Canada and Greenland? He wants access to their minerals. He doesn't want Canada to be a 51st state. That's never going to happen. But he wants a deal. So he's like trolling the shit out of them to get a better deal. Greenland, I don't see them becoming a state either. I don't even know if I see them becoming a territory. I see them becoming an independent nation that is considered a protectorate of the United States in some way, with certain obligations we have to defend them, and therefore access to Greenland's minerals, which they cannot develop, which Denmark cannot develop. There's really not probably another nation in the world that can develop those resources other than the United States and China. Now, if you're Greenland, who would you rather make a deal with? I'd take orange over red any day in that deal. All right. So let's Zone 6, Eric says a nickel will end up being worth a quarter in scrap. A nickel is probably already worth about 10 cents in base metal value right now because it's got a copper core. I don't know if they changed the nickel recently or anything and that changed, but nickels are – go to coinflation.com and check out – somebody do that for me. Somebody find out for me, what is the base metal value of the United States nickel right now? I'd be interested to see. With that, let me go ahead and remind you of a couple things, and then we'll take your questions. First of all, I do want to remind you that the book, Laws of Life, is coming out on the 12th of May, and that is only 7 days away. So Monday week, right, is the drop of the book, Laws of Life. All the ambassador positions filled up really, really quick. So we don't have that anymore. But if you just want to get a reminder, there is a form in the post. Laws of Life is coming on May 12th on the blog. Fill out that form, and I'll send you a reminder like the day before it drops. And after it drops, I'll send you a link to go ahead and order it. I keep getting the same question. I found it on Amazon. Did I tell you to find it on Amazon? I did not tell you to find it. I said to fill out the form, which is just your name and email. But I'm not picking on you, but I never said go buy it on Amazon and pre-order, did I? And there's a reason. And that is because you can't. And the reason you can't is because I can't. For some reason, as a new author into the Kindle Direct Publishing platform, KDP, I can make the ebook available for pre-order. I cannot make the print book available for pre-order. I know that other authors do that. I've pre-ordered books before. I pre-ordered Jim Shockey's book, for instance, and what have you. But they're using large publishing houses, not KDP. I don't know if maybe once I am an established author with KDP, if I'll be able to pre-order it, but I can't do it. It's not doable. It can't be done. There is no option for it. I'm sorry. I can't do that. If you want to pre-order the Kindle, if you search for Laws of Life Spirico on Amazon, it will pop up. You will find it, and you can do that. If you want the hard copy, and I really want as many hard copies to hit the ground next week as possible, you have to order it after it goes live. I cannot change that. I am sorry. But I'd really love you guys to pick up this book, maybe pick up a copy, send a copy to a friend. Somebody asked me today, what is the ideal age range for this? I would say it's probably mid-teens and up and for everybody. There is some tough talk in it. There is some four-letter words in it. The F word is not in it. There's actually a discussion about that in the introduction about how you read things like effing. But it's tough talk because it's me. It's what you would expect from me. And so I would say like 14, 15. My 14-year-old grandson's reading it right now, and I think he's getting a lot out of it. So that is about how old you have to be to care about something like this. And I would say like ideal demographic, 15 to 35. That's just in my head. Like those are people that still have a lot of life ahead of them, and they've been told a lot of bullshit about why they can't succeed. And this book completely breaks that and then tells them how to succeed. Because I personally think that the average young person is tired of being told how much opportunity they have. And so, you know, just pull yourself up by your bootstraps. They're just tired of hearing that shit from boomers and Xers, right? Like fuck you. Like, you had it easy compared to us, and they're right and wrong. You know what we're not telling them? How? How? Like, quit whining and do is not how. This book is a blueprint to change your stars. That's what it really is. Next up, as you guys know, you can always help me out by doing your online shopping starting at tspaz.com. I got a cool thing for you guys today. You guys know I love the DeWalt electric pruners when they came out. I bought a set, and I actually bought a second one recently because that way two people could be working at the same time. And the only thing about it is it's kind of big and bulky, and my wife's not in love with the weight of it. And when I was looking for it, I put in just DeWalt pruners, found the one I was wanting, and I saw this thing pop up that you're looking at on the screen right now. And I'm like, it looks like DeWalt because it's black and yellow. But when I looked at it, it was made by a company called Yawv, and Y-A-W-V. And I thought initially, I really didn't look at it. I thought, well, it's just a knockoff product that they made look like DeWalt, so screw them. And the reason is, there's a problem that I have with a lot of these off-brand tools, and it's right here, the battery. Because I had a tool that looked exactly like this one in form and size. It was made by a company called, I don't remember now. It was a red tool. Kind of looked like it was Milwaukee Red. More on that in a second. And I bought it, and it worked great, and then the batteries died. One died really fast, and then the other one died like in a couple months. When I say died, I don't mean that they didn't hold the charge long at all. I mean, it would not take a fucking charge at all. Dead battery. Okay, fine. It's an off-brand tool. Battery shouldn't be that expensive. 1.5 amp hour battery, $88 freaking dollars. No more of this shit. I'm not throwing money away. DeWalt came out with the new tool, and I'm like, that's what I'm going to do. So when I saw this, I thought this is another repackage. No. Do you see what that battery is right there, guys? That's a DeWalt battery, and it works with all the 20-volt DeWalt batteries. So the weakness in these off-brand tools comes down to the power supply. But if you are a DeWalt person, you already have DeWalt batteries, and so you just buy it as a bare tool for $47.50. Awesome. And my wife won't stop taking this. Like, she loves this tool. She won't put it down. And it's because it's light, it's diminutive. Turn it on. You know, you got your... And it's just a great tool overall, electric pruners. So here's the other side of it. It comes in the top three big brands for power options. You can get it for the Makita 18-volt system. You can get it for the Milwaukee 18-volt system. And you can get it for the DeWalt 20-volt system. All you're buying is the bare tool and using the platform that probably, I bet you 90% of people in this audience who have cordless power tools are using one of those three. And those of you that don't, you're either using your higher end maybe a little bit, and you like the battery warranty, maybe you're commercial, you're using Rigid. And if you're cheap, and I mean cheap in kind of a good way, right, you're using Porter Cable. Or you're using Craftsman, which is at this point actually DeWalt, by the way, I'm just saying. Anyway, if you're on one of the platforms, though, DeWalt 20-volt, Makita 18-volt, Milwaukee 18-volt, check these out. And I'm going to do some more research into this company now. There's times that you want a power tool that you're not going to use that much, and you don't want to spend DeWalt money or Makita money on it, or Milwaukee money on it or Rigid money on it. but you also don't want another power platform, and you already have all the money invested in it, so why would you buy this other thing? So I'm going to check out some of their other tools and put them through their paces. I do not think this has the quality of a DeWalt, but for what it is, for the money, I think it's being frugal, not being cheap. All right, with that, let's go ahead and take some questions before we completely wrap up. First of all, JD Draft sent me a $4.99 super chat. Thank you so much for that, JD. He said, definitely did not set my mom's compost on fire, adding ash from the wood stove when I was a kid. That never happened. So he must have added some ash that was actually embers and set it on fire. Well, thanks for the confession and the super chat. Trial and error. What hardware wallet for keeping my Bitcoin on are you currently recommending? I don't really have a Bitcoin wallet that I specifically say, get this one. It can be a cold card. It can be a Trezor. It can be a Bitbox. Like all of them are good. Because of some bullshit ledger pulled, I no longer recommend that. So it's more exclusionary than inclusionary in my list. Don't use Ledger, use somebody good. Okay. I recommend the Trezor Model T in combination with Exodus. And I do that because Trezor has good customer support and Exodus has good customer support. You can also use the Trezor with their own soft product or other soft wallets because they work in combination with each other. One's more of an interface and one more is a security device. And they have good customer support. I don't want to be your customer support. So if I say use Bitbox and you're like, I don't know how their customer support is. I don't use it, so I don't know. They might be just fine. But be like, well, Jack, how do I do this? I don't want to be in that business. So the reason I recommend those specifically is because I know that if you have a problem and you reach out to support with Trezor or you reach out to support with Exodus, you're going to get an answer. But use what works for you. But above all things, keep it updated. Don't lock it in a box somewhere and let it just disappear for 5 years without being software updated. Plug it in about once every 2 months and refresh it with the latest updates, okay? And make sure you securely save your seed phrase. That means stamped in the metal or something like that in a place where if fire and brimstone rain down, once you clear the rubble, you can get it back, okay? I just met somebody in Tennessee who talked about a major disaster that occurred because of Hurricane Helene, and one of the things that they ended up losing was their seed phrase. That should never happen. I'm not going to beat the person up that it happened to, but learn from their mistake. What you don't think can happen can, because your hardware wallet can blow away like a fart in the wind, and as long as you have the seed phrase, you can still get your coins back, okay? Hunter says, do you think the .gov is secretly stacking once they have set amount, then they announce that they're doing it? I don't know. It's kind of difficult for that to happen. The Federal Reserve banks may be stacking quietly. I think it's more likely that there's nation states stacking that are not us. However, this whole revenue neutral thing, you know, I just realized something. I did explain over-the-counter Bitcoin buying. If our government's going to buy large blocks of Bitcoin, they're not going to buy it on Coinbase. There may be a big deal being worked right now for billions of dollars worth and building this consortium of sellers. You have to find people willing to sell their Bitcoin. So it might be less that they're stacking it and more that they're working out the first big giant buy. Because this is what's going to happen. And there's a lot of times I say this could happen. I'm going to tell you this is what's going to happen. Sooner or later, there's going to be a major nation. Anybody at the G20 level would be big enough. Their central bank is going to say, we have, you know, and it's not going to be like what Orange Man did with basically the money we stole from Silk Road we're going to make a reserve out of. There's going to be a central bank that says, we now have a Bitcoin reserve of 50,000 Bitcoin or 100,000 Bitcoin or more. And once one does it, others will have to do it. And then it's on. That's when everything breaks. That's when this whole over-the-counter, like, people are going to have to fight for what they get. And the price will go parabolic when that happens. I'm not saying it's going to happen tomorrow. I'm not saying it's going to happen next year. I'm not going to say it's going to happen 5 years. Eventually, it will happen. And when it happens, there is only one result that can occur at that point, because the scarcity is just largely not understood. When we start speaking in Satoshis versus Bitcoin, is when people will fully grok and understand this, and people are going to be like, wow, you have 100 million Satoshis, which would be one Bitcoin, right? There will come a day when having 10 million Satoshis, 0.1 Bitcoin, will be a big fucking deal. A big fucking deal. Dan the Delivery Man, what chainsaw do you recommend for dropping pine less than 18 inches, then homestead maintenance after that half-acre woodlot? Whatever you want, man. I mean, a good Husqvarna, right, like Farm Boss or Steel Farm Boss or good Husqvarna or something like that is probably your best long-term play. 18 inches, you know, you're looking at, what, a foot and a half? I mean, even a small electric chainsaw can handle that, especially pine. I have the Oregon in the plug-in electric and the battery electric, and I have the DeWalt in 20-volt little 14-inch bar. Was it a 14-inch bar on it, or is it like a 9-inch bar? It's a little bitty thing. They're all fantastic. I mean, I don't want to use them on trees quite that big, but I can. But I would look to Husqvarna and steel would be my two go-tos if you're looking for true longevity in your purchase. If like you need to drop like 20 trees and then maintenance is like pruning and shit like that, like even like a Poland Wild Thing or something, they're like $120 brand new. We'll do that for you. But those aren't saws that even if well-maintained, you're going to be using 6-7 years from now if you use it regularly. Again, Husqvarna and steel are kind of my two go-tos on that long distance. So if you want to email me and be more specific about what you're really looking for, and then maybe I would come off of that higher end recommendation. Nurse Wang says, comment, our mayor has a mulch business. It just caused a major fire a few days ago. It took a few days to put out. Pine Barrens, New Jersey. Yeah, I'll tell you one thing about pine. When pine gets to going, all that resin, that shit burns, and it burns in dark smoke too. Matthew says, comment on Slate, we can't get small pickups anymore due to CAFE regulations. EV is the only way around that until we can undo CAFE. There's a lot of shit beyond just that too. There's a lot of problems from a regulation standpoint. And I really think though, if Chevy or GM Chevy or Ford or Dodge, or even like Toyota went to, because these guys, like, you cannot go to the Trump administration for anything they can. You know, when you have billionaires and multi-billion-dollar corporations saying we want a deal, the Trump administration is wide open for that. And I think if Toyota said, hey, we build trucks right now in, like, Tennessee. If Ford's like, you know, we build trucks right now in Texas. We want to bring back the small truck. The small, affordable, daily driver, everyman's truck. Standard cab, 6-foot bed, basic options. We want to do that, and we can't. We want to build it here in America. We want to do that, and we can't. There'd be a carve out. Quick. I don't think they want to do it. I think they're so obsessed with how can we convince people to spend $75,000 on a pickup truck. They don't even want to think about $20,000 pickup trucks anymore. They really don't. The whole model is becoming an owner's versus, you know, renter's model. The vision of Tesla, right? The vision of Tesla is within 5 years, you have fully autonomous Teslas. And if you bought one and it didn't come with it, here, pay us another $5,000 and we'll give you the capability electronically. You just pay the bill and we'll beam it into your car. But they don't want to do that, so they can say, hey, you know what? You could sleep while your car drives you, you know, on your long road trip. They want to take over the Uber market without drivers. They want you to be able to register on, like, Tesluber or something, right, to make your vehicle, and you set a schedule of when your vehicle's available. And then, like, in the middle of the day when you're not working on it, you don't need your vehicle that day, you look out and go, oh, look, you get a little alert on your phone, right? And your vehicle, you might even have, like, you know, mission delivered. The person's going to need the vehicle to take them to this place. It will be gone from 2:00 and back to your house by 3:30. Approve. Yeah, I'm good. Click. And your vehicle just drives out of your driveway, goes down the road, picks up Marvin, takes him to his place, drops him off, and comes back and, you know, pulls back in maybe even pulls back into some sort of new charger finagle thing where it pulls in, it automatically starts charging. That's the vision of Tesla right now. That's what they're trying to actually accomplish. And the odds are they will get there. This is where I remain skeptical. Not is the technology capable. We can do this right now. What it's not good at is when things are not the way they're supposed to be, like a lot of rural neighborhoods, small streets, side streets. Like, as long as you're sticking to like major roads and known suburbs, these vehicles have enough technology, they can do this right now. But the regulatory framework, you know, what happens if some wing nut from the left wins the next election at a national level? What happens if, to this whole plan that Trump has, if the midterms go poorly and they end up with something like 55 Democrat seats in the Senate and a commanding majority in the House? Nothing but impeachments. That's what he didn't get removed from office, but it's nothing but impeachments for 2 years and everything stalls, right? And then either the Democrats pay for that stupidity in the next election or it works out for them. Like, there's all kinds of things that can derail the ability to regulatory allow what's going on right now, what Tesla wants to do. But that's what they want to do. That's just a Tesla Uber going to trademark that one, Odyssey Camera says. Anyway, guys, I need to go. Thank you so Anyone Can Golf says Ryobi. Yeah, they don't have a Ryobi option, but I wonder if somebody does. I think that's another thing you're going to see is a lot more of these third-party tools that use existing battery packs, because the tool's easy to make. The battery is the technology. With that, guys, I will catch you tomorrow, and I will be with John Willis and Nicole Sauce for our first Tuesday coffee chat at 9:30 in the morning. Though I may reach out to Nicole and ask to push that to 10 a.m. because of some things I have to do with a certain dog tomorrow who must go to the vet and get some medication for some very basic things like grooming because she's a nervous Nelly. Take care, guys, and I'll catch you tomorrow with that first Tuesday coffee chat.
They said you should have a house the American way. $1 down, $1 a month, and you never have to pay.